This is the Anxiety Summit Season 2, and I'd like to welcome you to another fabulous call. I am your host, Trudy Scott. I'm a food mood expert, certified nutritionist, and author of the Anti-Anxiety Food Solution. And today's topic is adrenals, master glands of anxiety tranquility. Our guest expert is Dr. Alan Christensen. A very big welcome, Dr. Christensen.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Trudy.
It's a real pleasure to have you here, and I know you recently co-hosted the Hashimoto's Summit together with Andrea Nakayama and Isabella Wentz, who I interviewed on Season 1 of the Anxiety Summit, and I hear that went really well.
Yeah, that was a great event. It's a huge condition that affects so many and really is a strong tie-in to many anxiety symptoms as well, so it's a great message you've got, and I'm glad to support you in this as well.
Okay, great. Well, let me read your bio, and then I'll share a little bit about how I know you, and then we'll go right into our questions.
Sounds awesome.
Dr. Alan Christensen is a Phoenix, Arizona-based naturopathic physician who helps people overcome adrenal and thyroid disorders and achieve lasting fat loss and vibrant energy. He is the author of the best-selling Complete Idiot's Guide to Thyroid Disease, Healing Hashimoto's, A Savvy Patient's Guide, and an exciting new book that's coming out soon in January 2015. Is that correct? When does it actually launch?
You know, it's the very end of December 2014.
Okay, got it. Okay. The bio says 2015, but that's good to know, important to know. We're going to talk about that in a second. Dr. Christensen is the founding physician behind Integrative Healthcare, the Fix Hormone Club for men and women, and the founding president of the Endocrine Association of Naturopathic Physicians. He trains doctors internationally on the treatment of obesity, thyroid disease, and hormone replacement therapy. And you can learn more at www.drchristensen.com. And as you heard, there is a book coming out. It's a new book on adrenal health. And this is why Dr. Christensen is the perfect person to present on this topic today. We can't share the title of the book just yet, but I can tell you, you won't be disappointed. I was very pleased to have received an advanced copy to review and gave an endorsement, of course, and this is part of my endorsement. I can't share all of it because then I'll give away the title. But what I said is, as a nutritionist who works with anxious women, many of whom are stress eaters with burned out adrenals, I know this book will be a valuable resource for me and my clients. And that's all I can say right now. So I'm really pleased that the book's coming out, and I'm pleased to have you here.
Thanks so much, Trudy. That's wonderful.
Yeah, and I also heard you present at the NANP, National Association of Nutrition Professionals Conference, earlier this year, and you shared some really cutting-edge information on adrenal health. So we've got lots to talk about today. So let's get started.
All right, sounds good.
Good. We're going to talk about adrenals, master glands of anxiety and tranquility. So let's start with why the adrenals regulate the anxiety response.
For sure. So we have this whole mechanism that we call fight or flight. And it's something that in the distant past, when a lot of our life was spent in survival situations, it really served us. You know, we'd be chased by something and we would have this shift in our bodies, and that would allow us to run faster or to fight more strongly, and it saved our lives quite a bit. But now in the modern world, a lot of things trigger that still, and there are things that it doesn't serve us often. We're brought into this state of panic or anxiety by a lot of factors that are not always physically dangerous. And the adrenal glands, they really orchestrate that. They control that response.
So tell us what the adrenal glands are for someone who may not know. I think most people these days know about the adrenals and the impact that they can have on us, but where are the adrenals?
Yeah, and that's a great question. We hear the term, but not always clear exactly what we're referring to. So we've got our kidneys. You know, on our back we have these kidneys. We've got a sense of what they are and what they do roughly. But on top of them, there's a couple little lumps of fatty-like tissue. And you kind of imagine like a little pyramid. They're roughly pyramidal in shape. And they're about the mass of a nickel. So they're not all that big. And they make a huge variety of hormones, you know, 57 some odd or more hormones, like the 57 varieties of Heinz. But these things control so many aspects of our bodies. I mentioned about the fight or flight response. They also regulate our blood sugar. They control how much salt or potassium we've got in our bloodstream. They control our blood sugar levels, our inflammation that we have in our bodies and our joints, our immune system. They control a lot of our brain chemicals, and they even govern how all the other hormones get used in the body.
Wow, powerful, really, really powerful. And we know, you know, just sharing some of those roles, we can tie so many of these things back to anxiety. You know, just thinking about blood sugar and the immune system, and you mentioned the neurotransmitters and then all the other hormones. So can you talk about why some people are more prone to anxiety than others?
For sure. And there's probably some answers to that question that we do not have, but a lot of it we do understand. You know, I mentioned how the adrenals control a lot. When you realize that, you start to see how, if that's the case, then they've got a lot of jobs. And if they've got high demand in many areas, they're more apt just to go into a panic mode or into a survival state. So even if we're not being chased by the classic tiger, you know, like you mentioned, our blood sugar. If our blood sugar's crashing, that by itself can trigger high amounts of stress hormones to make us feel more anxious. Or if our sleep schedules have been thrown off, or if we're missing some key nutrients that are needed by the adrenal glands, or if we've got a high amount of some external toxin in our body, all these separate things. And it can also be thought of that it's not just a factor, but it's the collective weight of all of those adrenal stressors. It's how much we've got pushing those glands off at any given point in time that makes us more or less apt to have anxiety symptoms.
Got it. Yeah, and we've got so much going on in the world, lifestyle factors, and then we've got these dietary factors, and we've got toxins, and if we're not eating well, we're going to eat, you know, have low blood sugar, and then that's going to cause more anxiety, and we just get this vicious cycle where things get worse and worse. And is that what happens? That feeds off each other?
You know, it totally does. And the more factors there are stressing our adrenals, the less capacity they have to orchestrate it all. And once they have a harder time regulating and balancing your body, then it takes that much less to put them into a further state of overwhelm. Mm-hmm. So once they get really stressed out and compromised, it doesn't take even as much to keep them that way.
So in your practice, would you say that most people who come in have issues with their adrenals? Because I certainly see it with most of my clients.
You know, it certainly is common, isn't it? I do see that every now and then. I screen it pretty much routinely. You know, there were times before where I only did it when there was particular symptoms or special concerns, but I pretty much screen everyone nowadays for that. And yeah, like you said, it's the vast majority of people I see. Every now and then someone has perfect function, but so common. And, you know, people that seek us out, they know they're not feeling well. They've already got some struggles. So it is a biased population. Yeah, it's a very, very common problem.
Mm-hmm. You're right, because they are coming in because they're not feeling great. So we could, you know, assume that may be a factor. But I think a lot of people are out there are not feeling their best and not feeling great, and they're not thinking that there's something that they can do from a nutritional lifestyle point of view. And certainly there's a lot that we can do for the adrenals when it comes to lifestyle and nutrients and food. And the other thing that I think is pretty scary is I've seen some kids with adrenal dysfunction, which is just very, very sad.
You know, just this morning I was taking my son to school, and he's in elementary school. And we waited for a little while before they opened the playground, and I noticed, boy, there was probably a tenth or more of the kids had brand name, like, coffee containers from a coffee shop that obviously their parents picked up on the way to school. And you can see that most of them were, you know, I mean, coffee's bad enough, but most of them were not the coffee. They were like the grown-up dessert type things with the whipped cream and whatnot. So I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, all these elementary school kids thinking they've got to start the day with a ton of sugar and coffee. So you're right. There's more factors affecting the youth than we would have thought in the past.
Wow. Yeah, the fact that they've got that, and it's probably causing more problems, but then are they asking for it because they're absolutely, you know, wiped out and exhausted because of other factors that have contributed to adrenal issues. Very, very
sad. Yeah, they've gotten addicted, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned that, you know, some of these coffees are like dessert. The coffee is one factor, but then all the added sugar and all the other nasty things that are added are another whole problem, not to mention the cup, which has got the, you know, the chemicals in the cup, and it's a, yeah, a nasty combination.
Right.
So how do we know if our adrenals are healthy or if they're unhealthy?
Yeah, great question. And it's a good one, too, because there's many ways in which we think about our hormones or our health. And there's a lot of things that are core regulators, like we've got our digestion, our immunity, our thyroid. And some of these core things, when they're not right, they can cause really similar symptoms. So how do we kind of tease apart what's what? You know, the adrenal glands, the big thing that really stands out about them, that's different from all the other systems, is that they're regulating our daily rhythms. So they perform very differently in the morning than the evening. So the easy way you can tell if symptoms are more adrenal in origin is that they're different at certain times of day, and oftentimes in a way that's predictable. So if you know that, you know, at 3, 4 in the afternoon that you're going to crash, because you typically do, or if you know that you're going to try to go to bed at 10 but you can't fall asleep, and maybe at 10:30 you get this crazy second wind and your mind starts racing, you know, anything you know about your health, they have a daily pattern to them. You know, once we see a pattern like that show up, then we really think there's some involvement with the adrenal cycles.
So what should, tell us what it should look like. What is, what, how should good functioning adrenals make us feel throughout the day, just so we know what we're aiming for? Because some people have been feeling so bad for so long, they don't know what it feels like to feel good again or normal.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. You know, sleep and energy are big parts of that. So you should wake up feeling rested, and you should be alert, and it takes a little bit to shake it off, even for healthy people, but within maybe an hour or so, you should be pretty functional and ready to go. There's a thing called the cortisol awakening response. You know, cortisol is one of the more important adrenal hormones, and it's kind of like our internal automatic coffee machine. So we make this. Yeah, totally.
I love
like
it.
Like you got a coffee machine on a timer, and you can set it to go off when you wake up, and that's kind of what the cortisol awakening response is. So it makes it about an hour before you wake up, and it's part of what makes you want to get up and start doing things. So when that happens, yeah, you're awake and you're alert and you're functional. And as the day goes on, you're able to maintain good, steady levels of energy. And later in the evening, when it's, you know, a good bedtime, a little while after dark, you start to wind down, and you're still functional, and you're alert, and you're aware, but you realize that you're eager for some good quality sleep, and you can fall asleep pretty naturally and stay asleep throughout the night, you know, pretty much throughout the night, maybe one quick up if you're taking your fluid later in the day, but then you're going to wake up rested again. So when we're seeing something other than that in terms of the energy of the natural sleep, then that's a sign that they're not working right. That's really what you should shoot for.
Okay, so we could have issues where you're waking up feeling exhausted and you're dragging, and this is where you might want to go for coffee. You're not going to have that internal automatic coffee machine, which I think is just lovely. I really like that. Is that something you coined, that term?
My best knowledge, I don't remember hearing it elsewhere. But
I love it. That's really great. So, and then if you don't have that, then you're going to feel exhausted in the morning. Or as you say, a lot of people get that afternoon crash, and that's when they're going for the sugar because they need something to keep them going, or they might be grabbing a soda. And a number of my clients will go for a diet soda in the afternoon, which is not a good thing, but it's giving them that energy to just keep them going. And then the other thing you mentioned earlier is that second wind, where you're feeling pretty tired in the evening, but then you just get that second wind and now you want to go till like 2 in the morning. And that's a bad sign.
Yeah. Funny thing you mentioned about the diet sodas. People think about caffeine differently than they think about sugar, but they're really not different. So you take a diet soda, the caffeinated ones especially, and what's happening is that caffeine is causing your body to pump a whole lot of sugar in your bloodstream. So it's really no different than drinking sugar. It's the same effect. So, yeah, you're right. It's still a big issue in terms of staying stable on energy and staying stable on weight.
So tell us a little bit more about the diet soda. Why does it behave in the body like you're having sugar?
Well, there's two facets to that, one of which is just caffeine. So caffeine is a stimulant. And what it does specifically is it causes our body to take all of our stored energy. You know, when we make something called glycogen, we take good carbs and we pack them deep into our muscles. We pack them really tight and we make glycogen out of that. It's also in our liver. So caffeine causes us to just dump a whole lot of glycogen out. And it makes this big burst, this big rise in your blood sugar. The same thing would happen if you just drank a full sugar Coke. You know, it's the same phenomenon, the same rise in blood sugar. So that's part of it. Now, even the non-caffeine ones, though, there's been more and more evidence that just tasting something really sweet, your body goes through some of the same things it would do if you had just eaten something really sweet. You know, you may make a burst of insulin to receive the sugar you're expecting, but it's not coming, so your blood sugar drops, and then you're even hungrier, and you're really locked into a storage mode in which you can't effectively burn your calories.
Yep, and that's going to definitely affect your adrenals big time.
Yeah, so the adrenals have a strong tie-in with blood sugar. So whenever we get a swing in our blood sugar, a big drop in that, then that's one more thing the adrenals have to sort out. You know, they've got to work hard to make extra stress hormones because those stress hormones rescue your blood sugar. So the more erratic it is, the more stressed and the more anxious you will feel because of your adrenal glands.
Right, okay. Good. Well, I'm glad we covered that one because a lot of people are thinking that a diet soda is a better option. And we know, sugary sodas are not, but certainly the diet sodas are not good either. What about testing? Tell us what you recommend for testing or how you assess someone when it comes to adrenal function.
You know, a couple of ways to go. Easy thing is there's some pretty good quizzes that I've put together. I've done testing including salivary studies, blood studies, urine studies, even hair cortisol studies, actually. And I've checked symptoms of those who have had tests done. And I made a pretty statistically meaningful quiz. It's actually just at theadrenalquiz.com, and you can see what your level of function is and where that may be at. So that's one easy way. But testing, I do like the salivary tests as far as medical evaluations. You know, they're nice because they show not just how much adrenal hormones you're making at one point, but how much you make throughout the whole day. And that's often the part that we're most concerned about is, you know, are you making good amounts in the morning versus nighttime? Blood tests are fine. They're very good. They're accurate in some ways, but they've got a couple limitations. One of those is, Judy, do you like getting your blood drawn?
I don't mind it, but I know some people have a problem with it. Yeah.
You're not too bad yourself?
No.
Okay. There are many to where it's a very stressful experience. And the data is clear that for a lot of us, you know, where our stress hormones would be if we're minding our own business is not the same as where they would be when we're getting our blood drawn. So that can change it by a bit right there. But the big thing is just that we're seeing a snapshot through a blood draw. And I do like the blood draws. I typically do both and then do some comparison. But they are a snapshot. We're seeing a very dynamic process, but we're just seeing it at one moment.
Okay, great. Well, I'd love to go back to a few of these things you mentioned. So I'd like to come back to the blood and the saliva. But I wanted
sure.
to just ask you about your adrenal quiz because that sounds fantastic. I wasn't aware of that. And we're going to have a blog that goes with each interview, and we'll make sure to share that on the blog. So is this going to give us just an overall idea that there's something going on with the adrenals, and then doing the saliva test is going to tell us when it's high or when it's low? We're going to get specifics. Would that be a fair statement?
It would, and even deeper than that, it brings up a really good point. So adrenal function is not just good or bad. You know, this whole idea about the stress response came from a man named Hans Selye, and his work is very well established, and it's been around for many, many decades. And what he's shown is that this whole stress response is very real and very powerful, but it's not all or nothing. It's not that you're good or you're gooped up. It's that there's very distinct stages. And he talked about there being three completely different stages of being in higher stress. And so the nice thing about the adrenal quiz, and actually I made a mistake, it's just adrenalquiz.com.
Okay.
The nice thing about that is you not only learn if this is an issue for you or not, but you learn what stage of function you may have. You know, I call these being stressed, being wired or tired, or being crashed. And it's pretty relevant because the steps that you would take to really heal yourself at one of those stages may not be the best steps if you were at a different stage.
Got it. Yeah. So the these different, you're going to do different things at different stages.
Right.
Okay. And are those and that would that correlate with possibly doing saliva testing? You said you've looked at a lot of testing and then you created this quiz based on some of the test results that you have seen.
For sure. I used all those different types of data to create it, but the saliva tests correlate very strongly. They're my favorite single thing. You know,
okay.
If someone's in that first stage of a stress response, they're going to have more cortisol than they should. And they're going to have more amounts at the wrong times. So there's a healthy slope on a salivary test that shows you can really see that cortisol awakening response. You can see a morning spike, and then you can see a nighttime shutoff. And if someone has a fair amount of their scores above that line, they're at the first stage of being stressed. They're generating too much cortisol. The next scenario is, if someone has some scores below target, maybe their morning cortisol is low, and then their nighttime cortisol levels are higher, we call that the second stage, or being wired or tired.
Okay.
And then the last stage is where someone has the bulk of their readings below the normal curve. They're consistently below what's healthy, and that's what we call crashed. And, yeah, they're all very distinct.
Okay, got it. So we've got the three stages. The first is you're just producing way too much cortisol. The second is you've got some that may be high, some may be low, and this is the wired tired. And then third is it's pretty much low, and that's when you just like flatline.
Yeah, exactly. The first one is just too much. The second one is just wrong time. And the third one is just too little.
And then would you say that what often happens is that you start off in the first stage and you just go, and you've got all these onslaughts. And then eventually you get to the point where your adrenals cannot produce any more cortisol and you eventually end up in the third stage. Is it a progressive thing like that?
You know, it generally is. And that's more or less what happens, is that we put out higher amounts of stress hormone and then we get less able to regulate it. And then finally we get less able to even make it. So it does tend to progress through those cycles.
Okay. And then I've got a follow-on question about the saliva test. So if you could just recap for folks who may not have ever done one, how many times you collect throughout the day?
Yeah, the typical study involves four collections. You'll spit in some tubes and you'll do one first thing in the morning, typically between 8 to 9 a.m. Then you collect a sample at roughly noon, noon to 1, then one in the early evening, like 4 to 5, and then one closer to midnight. So that's the most common times. You'll see a little variation, but that's the best way to get really a full view of what the day's rhythms look like.
Okay, great. And then often these saliva tests will also measure DHEA.
They often do. They'll get some other pieces of data such as that.
Okay. I'm curious what you feel about the and this is a little bit off topic, but it is a test that is measured on some of the saliva tests, is the anti-gliadin antibody.
Sure.
For the gluten marker. Do you find that that's valuable?
Well, it's certainly an important thing to know about, whether or not someone has a gluten response. My friends who are the gluten experts, they tend not to put a huge amount of weight on the salivary gliadin antibodies alone. You know, it may not give a full picture on that. I personally like the tests that focus on the cortisol. There's still a little debate about how accurate other hormones are in the saliva and how accurate some of the findings are. But as far as cortisol goes, it's a much smaller molecule, and it does squeeze into the saliva more easily than others. And
okay.
There's strong consensus in medical research that it is a very meaningful thing to see in the saliva.
Yeah, I've seen quite a bit of research on it, and I know you talk about it and write about it as well. Do you ever do a middle-of-the-night collection if someone is waking in the night or you suspect high cortisol in the middle of the night?
You know, great question, and I certainly do deviate from script sometimes. There are situations to where someone has very strong unusual symptoms, and perhaps because I'm not clear, or perhaps because I suspect it and I want them to be clear on that, I think it may tie to their cortisol. And sometimes I'll encourage someone to really ignore the recommended times and then take a collection when they're experiencing the most pronounced symptoms. and just label, you know, when it was they collected that. And we can then look back and see how those findings fit with what they were feeling at that particular time.
Okay, great. Okay, now I've got a follow-on question on the blood, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Assuming someone is not stressed out about getting the blood and they don't have access to the salivary testing, would you recommend a morning cortisol? Because I know someone who will go to their regular doctor, they'll often just do the morning cortisol. But would you recommend doing a morning cortisol and then maybe a mid-afternoon one, assuming that that's when they're feeling stressed? Would the blood sort of correlate with that time of high stress as well?
It certainly would be better than no data, and I would make a further distinction if someone was relying upon a blood draw. So hormones can exist in different states in the bloodstream. They can be bound up and weak, or they can be loose and free, footloose and fancy free. So the saliva only ends up getting the free active portion of cortisol, whereas the blood has both. So when we do a blood test, we're seeing the total cortisol. It's not quite the same as the free fraction, but it can be. A blood test can be ordered to look at free cortisol. So if a blood test is someone's best option, I would encourage a morning free cortisol and then a sample later in the day, as late as practically possible, along with that is then nice as well.
Okay, great. Thanks for that clarification. Okay, excellent. Thank you. So now we've really been talking about adrenal dysfunction. So can you just clarify what the difference is between adrenal dysfunction and then adrenal disease?
Yeah, good question. And this has been a source of a lot of confusion or conflict where some in the medical world say, oh, there's no such thing as adrenal stress. There's no such thing as adrenal fatigue. Well, they're really confusing it with adrenal disease. And there probably have been some in alternative medicine who were not as clear at that distinction, and they really thought about adrenal stress more like adrenal disease. And, yeah, they're very different. So the difference is that with adrenal disease, the glands are not able to do what the body wants them to do. They're just unable to. The most common adrenal diseases are autoimmune, and there are times to where either the glands themselves or the things that regulate the glands have been damaged by the immune system, and they just can't really put anything out. Adrenal dysfunction, the glands can work. When we really get into what's happening, it's more about the whole adrenal system, like the hypothalamus, the pituitary, the adrenals, the thyroid, the intestinal tract. There's this whole system that determines what our daily need is for stress hormones. And that system, when we're under stress or crisis, it makes judgment calls. So the adrenals are actually doing what they're told in states of adrenal dysfunction. They're making what the body wants them to make. Whereas adrenal disease, they are not. The body wants them to do something, and they're doing something else.
Okay. And it's good that you make that point, that it's often not recognized that there is this thing called adrenal dysfunction or burned out adrenals, and yet we want to do something about it so we can feel the best that we can feel and not, you know, not have it affect the thyroid and immunity and inflammation and all these other things that are affected by adrenals when they're not functioning the best possible way that they can.
Yeah, and it's a great example of the disconnect between data and medical knowledge and then medical practice guidelines. You know, so much of what happens in medicine is really just passing out drugs, in all honesty, and if there's no drug treatments for a condition, then the condition is not thought to be an actual thing. But there's just mountains of research on all these things you're talking about, how these hormones affect our anxiety, how they affect our health. So it's a very real thing.
Yep, it really is. And we see it, we see it so often, and there's so much that we can do. And there's so much that can have an impact. So leading on to the next question then is, how can your diet and how can the environment and how can daily habits stress adrenals? How do we get into this situation in the first place?
Yeah, that's a big one. And somehow we're seeing more factors stressing them than we have in the past. And many, we first hear about that and think, well, you know, that's crazy. We're not being chased by tigers anymore. We have all these big physical dangers. But the stress response is turned on by things that are not always running and bearing claws, you know, chemicals turned on. They've shown that BPA, the plastic derivative, if you've got that inside of your body, it causes you to make more dangerous stress hormones, the same way you would if you were under stress. And we've also seen that the types of things that trigger it are things that are very common in the modern world, you know, just being interrupted. You know, you get a call, you get a text, you break your rhythm. That's a little stressor. And we also see that a lot of ways that we've made food to, you know, last longer and give us more fuel, the quickly absorbed types of foods, they throw off our blood sugar. And that causes our adrenals to have to work harder to control that. So the more we're exposed to fructose or sugar, that also puts more strain on them. So yeah, we've got large numbers of things. And it's really not just always one thing, but it's what our collective load is, the total weight of adrenal stressors that predicts our health.
So tell us a little bit about why fructose is so bad.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. You know, fructose is very different from other types of sugar. And sugar is a term I should really back up and clarify a little bit better. It means different things in different contexts. And I wish we didn't have that be the case, but it's the case. You know, so to a chemist or to a clinical nutritionist, sugar could be used interchangeably with carbohydrate or starch. But in most cases when we talk about sugar, we're talking more about sugar like in a recipe, which means something that's granulated and refined and processed. So in this context, I'd say think about the really small, simple sugars. So table sugar, for example, is sucrose, and that's one piece of glucose and one piece of fructose. They're bound up together. Other types of sweet things may have more glucose or more fructose, and then foods even. You know, some foods have more of one or more of the other. And it turns out that fructose is pretty different, that it goes straight to your liver. It has to be processed by your liver in ways that are not true for glucose or for other sugar molecules. And because of that, it really shifts a switch that causes your liver to change your cortisol, to change your stress hormones, and actually make them more aggressive.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And JJ Virgin is actually on the summit as well, and we talked to her about the sugar impact, and she talks all about the effects of fructose, and this connection to the adrenals and cortisol is very interesting.
Yeah.
So where would we find fructose? Give us some examples.
Well, anything that does contain sugar, that has sugar on a label, will contain fructose. Some foods are a little higher than others. And, you know, it takes time for our habits and our recommendations to catch up with the research. When I started practicing, we were very used to testing people's blood sugar levels. To be precise, we were testing blood glucose levels. And glucose and fructose are different. So someone could have a freight train of fructose about to wipe them out, mm-hmm. and you would never know that by their glucose levels. So for many years, we used to say that foods that had only fructose were better, safer. And that would be things like honey or even pure fructose or things like agave nectar or
yeah.
like a lot of fruit juices. So for quite a while, we thought someone who was struggling with diabetes or weight or blood sugar would be served by eating these foods only because we were ignorant in our testing. We were only testing for glucose and not for the fructose metabolism.
Yeah, and agave was so popular for a while, and there are some people who still feel that agave is okay, and it's not because it's got way too much fructose.
Yep.
So how do we, you talked about testing for, testing blood glucose. How do we assess for issues with fructose?
Yeah, good question. So you can measure directly, you can measure fructosamine, and that shows about a 3-week average of fructose metabolism. You know, there's blood tests, we always think about what's the range and what are the findings, what's the normal range. And for some blood tests that we've checked for a lot of years for a lot of people, healthy or unhealthy, we've got some decent reference ranges because we know what's average and what's typical in a population and what's not. But other tests, either they're not done that much or they're newer or they're more commonly done for those that may have some specific medical problems. And in those cases, we have to be more wary of the normal range because it may not reflect healthy function. And that's especially the case for fructosamine. It's really only done by pretty advanced doctors managing blood sugar. So they're not doing it on a lot of healthy people. Most people that have clear problems with their blood sugar. And many argue that we should not see scores even above the high 200 or 300 range, even though many labs might say you're normal up to 400 or 450.
Good to know. Good to know. And is this a blood test as well? I'm not familiar with fructosamine.
It is a blood test, yeah, and it shows about a three-week average for stored levels of fructose in the body.
Very interesting. Good to know. Thank you for sharing that. And you say that it shouldn't be above 200. That's the max that we should be seeing.
The upper 200s, 270, 280 is a common cutoff that's mentioned.
Oh, okay, got it. 270 to 280. Thanks for the clarification. Okay, great. And then I just wanted to make a comment on the BPA, because it's interesting that you talk about research showing that it impacts stress hormones, and I've seen other research showing how women who were exposed to BPA during pregnancy and they followed their kids, they found that their kids had more issues with anxiety. And I'm wondering if it was also the cortisol that was being effective. Very interesting.
You know, specifically what happened there is there's cortisol, there's stress hormones that we make from our adrenals, but here comes a big wrinkle. We also make those same stress hormones in our visceral fat. So our belly fat makes stress hormones. Now, it has to use the first things that the adrenal glands made. The adrenals make some strong hormones and some weak ones, but the belly fat can turn the weak ones into stronger ones, and it can make us feel more stressed. And BPA is one of the many factors that can make our visceral fat make us feel more stressed.
Very interesting. Wow. I did not know about that correlation. Fascinating. Okay. Now, we talked about processed foods, and you also talk about the impact of toxic proteins. Could you touch on that a little bit?
For sure. You know, what happens in digestion is that we're turning rocks into dirt. we're taking really big, complicated molecules and breaking them into little pieces. And it's good. It's normal. There's some kinds of rocks that are harder to break up than others. And those we think of as especially protein. They're very binding, sticky types of protein. You know, our top three would be gluten from wheat, and then albumin from egg, and then casein from dairy. Because of ways in which foods have changed, and also because of ways in which our digestion has changed, we're more apt to react to those proteins now than we were in the past. And reacting to them is kind of like having a flu. It's really a trigger to the immune system, a trigger to one of our stress responses. So it also can push us into the state of adrenal stress and storage.
Great. And I think it's important to make that clarification, because a lot of people think stress is stress, like a stressful life, and I've got to get to work, and I've got to take the kids here, and I've got all these things happening. But these things like the processed foods, the fructose, the fact that we might have a sensitivity to a certain food, those are all stresses on the body as well, and we need to keep those in mind. And, you know, we're just touching on a few here, but there's a lot of things that will stress our adrenals.
They sure are. And I think of it as a survival response. I try to use the word stress less, because you're right, people have so much of a preconceived notion about what it means. And what we think of naturally as stress is a huge thing. It's very important and has many impacts upon our health. But that's the big new message, is that many factors that you wouldn't obviously think of as stress act in the same ways and push us in that same survival storage state.
Yep, absolutely. So let's talk about something positive. And I love how you say food is the cure, it's not the enemy. So what is the best ways to heal your adrenal glands?
Yeah, you know, the main thing is really making sense out of your diet and getting a healthy relationship with food. So I talked in a lot of detail about the coming book about strategically using carbohydrates. You know, we've gone back and forth about, we don't really know what to do with them yet. You know, there was a time when everything that was bad about food we thought was fat. And because of that, we focused on eating high-carb diets. It was very, very common in athletic circles and wellness circles in the 80s to do nothing that had fat, and anything that was low fat had to be good. And I think now we might have almost gone the opposite way even too far. You know, now we thought that, well, anything carb has to be bad because the fat thing didn't work out very good. But You know, our food, when we think about the food's big, the big parts of it, there's really only three big parts. You've got protein, fat, and carbs. And I would argue that they're all needed. You know, we really need to have all of those. They've all got distinct roles, and they're all things that are essential and useful for us. So we need to have carbs. We need to figure out which ones are going to serve us. And the big new angle that I'm introducing is that we also want to consider our timing, you know, how they fit with our body's rhythms.
So let's talk about the timing aspect, because that's very interesting. And it's, as I said at the beginning of the interview, it's cutting edge and it's pretty different from what a lot of people are talking about. So let's talk about the whole timing aspect. And then as part of that discussion, you can probably tell us about some of the carbs that we might want to introduce at certain times of the day.
For sure. The general overview is that we respond very differently to carbs in the morning than we do it in the evening. And one idea that has been put out is that, well, if you're going to eat carbs, you should eat them in the morning so you can burn them up throughout the day. And there's just so many examples of ideas that seem so logical, that really make sense, but are just not how the body works when we really get down into the science of it. So we've got these rhythms. And insulin is a hormone that pulls carbohydrates inside of our cells. And where it pulls the carbohydrates is different per the time of day. So, for example, earlier in the day, insulin is more responsive to our belly fat. So more of the food, more of the carbs specifically that we're eating earlier in the day will end up being stored as belly fat, because we can't to actually ingest a food and process it and put it where we can burn it, it takes longer than you might think. It actually takes more than 8 to 12 hours. So a meal you put in with a lot of carbs early in the day, there's not time to really process it that well. So you've got to stuff it away as visceral fat. You've got to put it in the visceral fat stores. And the shortcoming there is that's fuel that, I mean, not only do we not want to grow our fat, but that's energy we've lost. That's fuel that we could have burned in some way that we lost access to. And now we're more run down or more tired because of it.
So we want to have more carbs later in the day.
The general idea is that they respond differently later on. So the ones we have in the morning are not really serving us for that particular day. They're more so just there and maybe being stored. But the morning is a good time for proteins. So proteins in rather large quantities, you know, between 25 to 35 grams, depending upon age, size, and gender, and ideally within an hour of waking up. What happens is that you start the day with proteins, your insulin receptors in the fat become weaker. So more of what you take in will end up going into your muscles throughout the day, and that will allow you to have more steady blood sugar. You know, it's really when the blood sugar drops that your adrenals have to dump out all the stress hormones, and that's when anxiety gets so pronounced.
Okay, so this is going to have an impact on anxiety, and it's also going to have an impact on our weight, because having more protein in the morning is going to result in less of these carbs that we might have been consuming being stored in the belly fat. Is that correct?
Yeah, so here's three things that are going on at the exact same time. When your body is not running smoothly, when you're really pushed into this survival mode, your fuel is not being burned well. You're not burning your fuel right away. And because of that, you're not burning fuel. This is like gas that's not going into your engine. So you're more tired. You're more sluggish. Now, the other part that's happening is because there's less available fuel, you have to put out more cortisol. And that helps to pull more glucose, more of the fuel, out of your stores. Well, that cortisol is a stress hormone. So along with being tired, now we're feeling anxious, we're feeling stressed, we're feeling panic. And then the last part of this equation, because we're not properly burning, because we're having to store and hold on to all this, we're gaining weight more easily. So the fatigue, the weight gain, the anxiety, the stress, for many people, those things all kind of cluster together. And this is one reason why that all happens, one way in which all three of those things play out in the same course of events.
Okay, so we want more protein in the morning, and then we want more carbs in the evening. So can you give us an example of a daily, what would a day look like? What would a good day look like in terms of breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and snacks?
Yeah, so breakfast, you know, a couple ways to go for breakfast. My favorite one is just doing shakes. There's good ones now that are non-allergenic, that don't use the binding proteins. And they can be made with small amounts of carbs, but good amounts of fiber. Throughout the day, it works well to gently add in more good carbs. So lunch is something to where the best ones still have some protein, but they've also got a little bit of carbs. Now, there's different kinds of carbs. There's ones that we can digest and ones that we cannot digest. That's what fiber really is. But there's something in between. And this is called resistant fiber or resistant starch, these different names. And this is what I like to really focus people on, is having diets that are high in good resistant carbs. These are ones that they're not absorbed by the small intestine. So what that means is they're not jumping into your bloodstream right away. You know, the best carbs versus the worst carbs, the difference is just how fast they get into our body. When they really pour into our bodies fast, we've got to make a lot of insulin and then a lot of stress hormones to manage them. So resistant fiber, what it does is it's only absorbed in the colon, primarily in the colon. So that means it takes hours and hours and hours before it starts to slowly trickle into the bloodstream. And when it does that, there's no big hormone output. It doesn't cause you to make insulin, make cortisol. It allows you to stay in that burning mode. The foods highest in resistant fiber are a couple things. White varieties of beans, such as navy, northern, and cannellini. The other very big food source is boiled potatoes that have been refrigerated. Those are some of my favorite carbs that really keep the body in that burning mode.
Very interesting. Why the refrigerated? Why do the boiled potatoes need to be refrigerated?
Yeah, good clarification. So that resistant fiber, it's naturally occurring in many foods. And for some foods, extreme high heat can destroy that. So, for example, if the same potatoes are baked, that's no longer the thing. Or if they're French fries or if they're potato chips, it's very, very different. But boilings cannot exceed the temperature of boiling water, 212 Fahrenheit at sea level. So the temperature is low enough to preserve a high amount of the resistant starch that's naturally occurring. Now, the next step is that more of that stuff can be formed in the cooling process, and that's called retrograde regranulation. So you get this big boost in the resistant fiber after refrigeration, after about 4 hours of refrigeration.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Okay, and then so now we've done breakfast and lunch, and so you would have some of these resistant starches at lunch, and then more at dinner?
More at dinner. And what happens here is this is a big part of sleeping well. I mean, I think everyone who's ever missed dinner intentionally or been on done fasting or been on very restrictive diets, you know, your sleep can really suffer when you're hungry. So if you're having the same amount of food, but more of it later in the day and more of it closer to bedtime, you know, you're going to sleep better. And the data has gotten so strong that sleep may be the third rail of weight loss, and it may be a bigger factor than regular diet or exercise for some people. So really eating to get deep restorative sleep is huge. And, of course, it's a huge thing for the brain chemistry. That's when we're really building a lot of our good neurotransmitters that make us feel safe and secure and help to offset the anxiety that's happening with deep quality sleep.
Great. And this is the one part of our talk, which is the tranquility part, and that's what we're aiming for.
Yeah.
Yeah, really great. Very interesting. And all of this is what you would say, you know, doing this, changing this way of eating is going to essentially reset your adrenals, so you're not going to feel anxious and you are going to feel tranquil. together with some other factors, which we can't get into today. And I know you talk about this in great detail in your book, and it's really fascinating. And it's can you share that you've done some research on this? Is that okay to talk about that?
Yeah, I sure can. Thank you. And that's the real exciting part is that, you know, we saw that so many are in this stage where they're anxious, you know, they're tired. For many, the weight is a struggle also. And like you said, with your clients that you see, people in those circumstances, they rarely have good adrenal rhythms. They commonly have very disrupted adrenal rhythms. So we did a study, and there's been a lot of data about how meditation or exercise or certain adaptogens, how various things can help to benefit the cortisol metabolism. But I wanted to see if we could make a big shift in a lasting way with just the diet alone. So we checked people's rhythms and also their quiz scores before and after 30 days of being on a very targeted diet. And it was pretty exciting. You know, we saw, you know, I actually physically handled all the stacks of scores going into it. I saw the big pile of all the findings. And boy, there really wasn't a good rhythm among them. And in the study, we enrolled people that had very pronounced symptoms of anxiety and of stress, and also people that had had at least about 3 diets that did not work over the past 2 years. So these are people that were already struggling with their health in a lot of ways. And to see the changes in them over the course of the month, you know, I can think of so many individual, just visual transformations. But we saw the numbers as well. You know, we saw that the average amount of adrenal stress dropped by over 50% just through the diet over the course of a month. And as much gloom and doom as the whole adrenal thing sounds like, the real message is, no, it's just understanding the enemy. It's just knowing why it is you're not feeling well. And the cool thing is once you know that, once you really have effective strategies that are targeted for you, it can heal. It can reset, and it can get fixed.
Wonderful. Well, congratulations on those results, and what lucky people to have been in your study, which is really, really great. And food, you know, to change it with diet, and that's what's so powerful. So many people forget about the amazing healing power of food, and as you say, food is the cure. If you just give the body the right fuel at the right time, it can do these amazing things. And how did you get in this direction of thinking that this is what you must do? What was the sort of, what factors led up to this?
Boy, my whole life.
Okay.
most recently, I've done a lot of work with thyroid disease, and for many people, they have substantial weight gain from thyroid disease that does correct when they get their thyroid healthy. But there's many to where that's not all that it is, to where their weight is more than that. And I've known about that in the clinic, but then I've been seeing all these statistics about this trend, this looming obesity crisis, this epidemic. And it's totally unprecedented. You know, the stats are now pretty scary. We're projecting that by the year 2030. So there's overweight, there's like a few extra pounds, and then there's obesity, where someone has a measurable increase of their body mass. There's formal definitions for this. And we've known that for some time. Sure, Americans are always thought of as having more prone to some of these issues for factors that are often thought to be temperament or personality. So it's been more dismissed when it's just American. But by 2030, the prediction is that the majority of humans on planet Earth will be obese. So not Americans, not heavy, but formally obese. And globally, you know, worldwide, we're also seeing animals, and we're seeing infants becoming obese in unprecedented rates. So I saw this and like, wow, there's a whole lot that we are not hearing about. And it's so far beyond just diet and exercise. And it's so tied into many other big symptoms of anxiety, of panic, of depression, of fatigue. It's the same glitch that's affecting all of this. And the rates of these things are just staggering, and they're increasing.
Yeah, it's scary, and it's wonderful to know that there's something that we can do about it. And we appreciate the work that you're doing, and it's really fantastic. Exciting, exciting that food and timing of food can make such a big difference. We're almost out of time, but I would love you to just touch a little bit on light therapy, because you talk about light pollution and how that it disrupts our sleep cycles, and you just talked about how important sleep is. And I'd love you to just touch on, you know, anything that you can share about the importance of light therapy.
For sure. And we're seeing this as being a big variable for these symptoms as well, these mood symptoms especially. You know, a lot of our state of health, our state of regulation, is built on an environment that we're no longer living in. You know, we're used to waking up with the sunlight, and a lot of rhythms that control our stress hormones, our happiness hormones, there are things that have to get wound in motion by the sunlight in the morning, and we don't have that. It's a funny thing, but, you know, we can navigate just fine indoors. You know, we turn on our light and we can see just fine. We're not running into things. Yet the intensity of the light indoors can literally be 1,000 times less than it is outdoors, you know, even on an overcast day. And our brains adjust our vision so we don't hardly notice the difference. But it does still affect our rhythms and our cycles. One of the most powerful things that I encourage for people to improve their anxiety symptoms, to sleep better, to have more stable energy, is to start your day with some sunlight. You know, and how to play that out, even on overcast days, even on cloudy days, the sunlight is way more intense than indoor light. Now, someone asked me the other day about, well, what about, like, you know, vitamin D on your skin? Yeah, in this particular case, it's not even your skin. It's really your eyes. You need to see the sun. So, I mean, I'm sorry, not look at the sun, but just have your eyes exposed to actual sunlight. So being outdoors, even somewhere shaded, you know, you can sit on your patio and read the morning paper or have your tea or have your breakfast. Of course, if you are walking or active, if that's appropriate for you, that's wonderful. That's great. And then the next thing we think about is places to where people have time frames and daylight available times to where that may not be practical. There's been long understanding of seasonal affective disorder, about those that get quite depressed when the days are shorter in the wintertime. And there are good light boxes. And you can find those now for the neighborhood of $100. You can find light boxes. You want ones that generate 10,000 lux, and you want ones that hold the lamp up and shine it downwards. So you could be looking down at a surface, and the light would reflect off of that surface towards your eyes. And same thing, you could have your breakfast or read your paper with that light box above you in the morning. But yeah, half an hour, within an hour of waking, is one of the biggest, easiest resets you could ever imagine.
Wonderful. So we want to be either outdoors if we can, in the sun or in a shaded area, walking if possible, or using a light box. And you're saying use it, be in that outdoor area, or use the light box for half an hour. And then within an hour of waking, I just want to make sure I got that right.
Yeah, within an hour of waking up, okay. Get yourself in some light for half an hour.
I love it. And I love those light boxes. And there are some lamps that you can use on your desk that do just that. They're above you and they shine down. So that's what you're saying,
yep.
Is good.
Perfect. Yeah, they're easy to find.
Yeah, excellent. And I'm glad you mentioned the seasonal affective disorder, because there's actually research showing that some people are more anxious in the winter. So we often hear about the depression, but a lot of people are more anxious in the winter as well. And it could be related to low serotonin, which takes it up when we've got the winter blues going on and winter anxiety. So I'm glad you mentioned that. And the light therapy is fabulous for that as well. Well, this has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing this and for bringing to light all this interesting and valuable research, because we know mood problems are on the rise. We know obesity is a huge issue. People have got no energy. And as you mentioned at the beginning, Dr. Christensen has this new book coming out on adrenal health. And when you register for this free gift that he's kindly offered, you'll also get updates on when this book comes out and more information about the book. So the free gift is 49 fresh recipes for a stronger body and more vibrant you. And we'll share that link on the replay page and in the blog. And then I'll also share that quiz that Dr. Christensen talked about. Any final words of wisdom that we didn't get to that you'd like to share?
Yeah, thank you. The big message I always want people to come away from it with is that our health is dynamic. You know, our bodies are always rebuilding. And given the right circumstances, I mean, we change literally every atom over the course of a year. So when you learn things like what Judy's teaching with this summit, and you change your life, you take out the blocks to your health and you add in more positive things for your health, the sky's the limit. You know, it can improve in such radical ways. So never give up on that vision.
Thank you. What an excellent ending. What an excellent ending for this fantastic talk, The Adrenals, Master Glands of Anxiety and Tranquility. Thanks again, Dr. Christensen. It's been fabulous. And I wish you great success with your book and sharing this message with many, many people who need this information. Thank you.
And thank you for doing this summit, Trudy. This is such a hugely important cause. It's behind so much suffering. So it's a great service you're providing.
Well, thank you. Thanks again. And thank you, everyone, for joining us for another amazing call on the Anxiety Summit. I hope you've got as much out of this as I have, and I look forward to hearing you on one of the other great interviews.